I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned into Modus Operandi. It's a job that you take on until you die. You head one of the world's biggest organizations spanning every country and every continent. And every day, millions upon millions of people listen to your every word. Your dictates can shape society. But we're not talking about the CEO of a multinational corporation. We're talking about the Pope. This week, we'll dig into the situation at the Vatican as an ailing 87-year-old pontiff considers stepping down. All right, let's get into the MO. Pope Francis, born Jorge Mario Bergoglio in Argentina in 1936, was tapped to be the 266th Pope of the Roman Catholic Church over a decade ago. He's the first Pope elected from the Americas. The child of Italian immigrants to Buenos Aires, young Jorge studied to become a chemical technician. But after a severe bout of pneumonia that saw part of his right lung removed, he felt a calling to the church. He holds several postgraduate degrees and has ruffled many feathers among more conservative members of the church. But now, the 87-year-old pontiff says he may step down early, sending shockwaves in the Catholic community, especially with his most recent comments about the conflict in Ukraine while speaking to Swiss broadcaster RSI, saying that Kiev would show courage if it raised a white flag and entered peace talks with Russia. Those comments have been harshly rejected and rebuked by the West and Zelensky. Joining us to discuss Pope Francis and the role of the Catholic Church around the world is Timothy J. Gordon. He is a Catholic philosopher, author, and podcaster. His show called Rules for Retrogrades can be found on YouTube and anywhere podcasts are syndicated. His latest book, The Case for Patriarchy, is out now. Thanks for joining us, Tim.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So in late February, we saw Pope Francis once again be hospitalized briefly for the flu. I mean, he's an 87-year-old man. We know he's had some health problems in the past. He has now publicly stated that should his health get in the way of him performing his papal duties, that he would step down as pontiff like his predecessor, Pope Benedict, who was, I believe, the first ever to do so. My question to you is, should Pope Francis do this? And will this become a trend among future popes? And would that be a good thing or a bad thing?
No, it's not a good thing. It is arguably a very bad thing that Pope Benedict XVI did it, not just because the pontificate of Francis has been so catastrophic, which it has. It was a bad thing in and of itself. By the way, little correction, there was another pope who did it about 600 years before Benedict XVI. The reason that it's not a strong correction, a thick correction, is because that was essentially a young pope who didn't know what he's doing. He retired, absconded from the chair of Peter a couple of weeks, maybe a month into the pontificate after not knowing what to do. This was not the case with Benedict XVI, who had been the number two in the church, the doctrinal chief, we call it the CDF prefect, for, you know, almost three decades under John Paul II. Before becoming pope, he was the presumptive pope. Everyone knew he would carry forward the program of John Paul II, even before John Paul II passed away. So it was extra strange when Benedict XVI stepped down. In this time of the year is when we think about it, from February to March, it's been a strange ride for, I think, all the world, but especially for us Catholics. An announcement by Benedict XVI in late February of 11 years ago that he would do so, and most people know later that night, lightning struck St. Peter's. It had been done once before by essentially a boy pope. It's been very, very bad for the church, largely because of who Francis is, but also just because it runs contrary to, we've had 266 popes. The notion of the pontificate is that it's a lifetime tenure, a lifetime appointment. And what has grown organically over the two plus millennia of Christendom, according to Roman Catholicism, is what we call the Vatican. The news refers to it with the Vatican. This means the dicasteries, like the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which I was talking about earlier. They help even an old man pope, even an ailing old man pope who had, say, Parkinson's disease, like John Paul II had, to still run the church from the chair of Peter. And this is why it's especially weird that Benedict XVI stepped down, because he knew that the church is equipped to handle really all situations. JP II had gotten very sick, and he was tasked with, particularly in the doctrinal area, keeping things running. And there are other dicasteries besides this CDF as well. That's the most important one. But there are others. There are 8 dicasteries. So it's strange that he stepped down. It turns out Benedict had had a fascination with the theology of a pontiff who steps down for many decades. We know this from studying the earlier writings and some of the friends of Benedict XVI. And it seems to be an area of liberal theology, if I could borrow the expression. Not that Benedict was known as a liberal. He was not. He's known as a conservative. Francis, as a true liberal theologian, loves the notion and said, I think in the second or third year of his pontificate, before he was as old as he is now, when he was still in his 70s, I like the idea of this. Well, of course, theological liberals love the idea of innovation, and it wouldn't surprise me to see him stepping down. Of course, the rule of secular politics that liberals never give up power seems to be the only thing stopping Francis from doing so now. But it's an open question. I think it's negative for the church. The church is equipped to have an old, aged, sick, infirm pontiff, even one who's suffering from a neurological disorder like Parkinson's disease, and it makes it especially strange that Benedict XVI did it after being the number two guy, the go-to guy, for many years while his predecessor, John Paul II, was ailing as pope.
Okay, I stand corrected on Benedict XVI. I didn't go that far back in history, and a very long history the Catholic Church has. I'll put an asterisk on Benedict as the first to do so in modern times. So what do you think the impact of this Pope Francis has been among the Church and with Catholics all around the world? What's going to be his legacy?
That's a difficult question. And the response is strongly bifurcated among Catholics. In the tenure of Francis, he has sort of galvanized opposition among conservatives who in theological circles, like cultural and political circles, can be languid. They suffer from torpor. And conservatives are generally happy people who are trying to live their lives, their best life, family lives, more often than not. And so they're not ready, you know, at the sticks to make changes or to wage counter-revolution against the revolutionaries. And it doesn't really work the same way in the church when you have someone like Francis, who's essentially a revolutionary, attempting to wage revolution on unchanging doctrine in the church for 2,000 years. So his legacy will be that he galvanized a re-embracing of tradition. You ask someone like me, I'm a Latin Mass Catholic. My home parish is in New Orleans, almost 2 hours away, where I can go to the Tridentine Latin Mass. And this got changed around Vatican II when our parents were young. And there are some remnant class of Catholics that went to the Latin Mass the entire time, but it was really under Francis that young people returned to the Latin Mass because things got sufficiently bad. The attack on tradition writ large got sufficiently aggressive to drive a bunch of 20-year-olds to the Latin Mass, which if you go to any TLM parish, Latin Mass around the country, you're going to see mostly young people now. That is the opposite narrative to the one that the liberals, the theological liberals, of the 60s during Vatican II were telling, oh, young people want hippie crap and guitars and kumbaya. Not so, but we didn't know it as, I was kind of had some part in helping to popularize the TLM among other Catholics. Who I attended the TLM before Francis came into the See of Peter, but most young Catholics have kind of only come in as a sort of counter response to Francis. And in some sense, that's a good thing. There are those like liberal Catholics who are essentially a circular square. You can't be a liberal and a Catholic, who of course love Francis, but they're circular squares. They're very, very confused dogs chasing their own tails. And I would just say that Francis in many ways has flushed out the mole, because the church has had this, our enemies want to believe it's a death spiral happening since before Vatican II, since essentially the Pope who called Vatican II in 1958, where, you know, it's an embarrassed kind of self-loathing when the church confronts herself on the stage in front of the world, instead of proudly proclaiming what the Catholic Church always had for 1950 years, now all of a sudden is sort of shamefaced about the announcement of her truths. Since around that time, let's call it the onset of Vatican II, 1962, the church has been in this spiral of shame and embarrassment for bringing the truth. And this became, like I said about Francis, notable enough over the last 11 years that I think a lot of people are realizing there will need to be a Vatican III, partly as a clarifying response to the pontificate of number 266 Francis, and partly as a clarifying response to some of the ambiguities of Vatican II. I think that's going to be his legacy.
All right, coming up next, the Catholic Church is the single biggest landowner all around the world outside of government entities. Why does the church own so much land? We'll discuss it when we return with Timothy J. Gordon. Sit tight. The MO will be right back.
I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Welcome back to the MO. I'm Manila Chan. Timothy J. Gordon is back. Thanks for sticking with us, Tim. All right, let's talk about the role of church in our society as a whole, the Catholic Church, and more broadly, perhaps Christianity. According to a 2019 Pew Research poll, an overwhelming majority of Americans, two-thirds of them, believe in the principle of separation of church and state. Does that separation truly exist? And how would you compare or perhaps contrast that with how other countries don't separate the two? I mean, take, for example, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Regardless of what anyone thinks of that country, as a matter of governance, religion, in this case Islam, is part of the state.
That's a very, very fascinating question. And it's got a couple of parts, and I'm honored to be able to respond to it. First off, what a lot of America, I'm also a constitutional scholar. I went to law school pretty much only to study the Constitution. And what most Americans don't know or have been brainwashed or lied to about is this idea of the separation of church and state. This country was founded in 1788 is when the ninth state ratified the Constitution under the promise that took 3 years to make good on by the Federalists, those who wanted it ratified, to the Anti-Federalists, those who did not want the Constitution ratified, until the summer of 1791, a Bill of Rights, right? Really the first eight amendments to that Constitution, which stood as guarantors of specific rights which weren't addressed in the first, second, or third Articles of the Constitution. And Amendment 1, the only amendment in the entire Bill of Rights to mention specifically the Congress, stipulates something that most Americans just don't know. And it applies particularly about separation of church and state, First Amendment, and it applies to all the other Bill of Rights amendments as well. The Bill of Rights was only meant to constrain the national government, the Congress. And that's why Congress is mentioned in the First Amendment. So it's Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. The state governments, which remember back then when America was truly America before we really lost our country, the state legislatures made all of the sexy, important, moralistic legislation. And they all were assumed, 13 out of 13, by even Jefferson, who had a funny relationship with Christianity. He didn't love it, but he helped Madison to frame Amendment 1. And they assumed that 13 out of 13 states would have an official sect of Christianity. And most of them would be Protestant, they figured, because most Americans were Protestant. But they thought 13 out of 13 would. And only 8 of 13 state legislatures adopted an official sect under the First Amendment of Christianity. What this means is the First Amendment, until this year, 1947, a case called Everson versus Board of Ed, which reversed the meaning of the First Amendment, they all had, 8 of 13, it could have been the other 5, they just opted against it, to have an official establishment of some Protestant sect. It was mostly Congregationalist, Puritan sects of Christianity in the North and Church of England in the South. They had official state religions. And as a matter of fact, the First Amendment meant Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. What it really meant is that Congress will not disestablish official state establishments of Christianity. That was literally from 1791 until 1947, a solid 150 years of what I call true America, federalism. It just meant that the national government couldn't commandeer the sexier lawmaking powers of the states. It's called the police power of the states. Comes from the 10th Amendment that conservatives love. And what it really means is, yeah, we can have moral legislation. The libertarians don't love that. But the moral legislation should all come from state legislatures for the several states. If you don't like your state's moralizing legislation, or I'm not a Baptist, but I live in Mississippi, I'm a Roman Catholic, I could move if it bothered me enough. I could transfer state lines. I could go to Louisiana, where there are a lot more Catholics, if it really bothers me. You can vote with your feet. That's until the national government started swallowing the whole. And that's when, in that case I mentioned earlier, Everson versus Board of Education, it was 7 of 9 SCOTUS jurists, 7 of 9 who were Freemasons. They reversed the meaning of the First Amendment. They used something called incorporation doctrine. They said now all of a sudden the Bill of Rights applies to the state legislatures as well as the Fed. And now it means the opposite of what it had meant for 150 years, that the Congress, really the court, could disestablish state religions, even though that was the whole purpose of the First Amendment. So because, you know, the Masons on the court and the lawfare and the culture have such power, they've convinced everyone over the last 60 years that essentially the opposite purpose of the First Amendment was the case. It wasn't. So separation of church and state is not a good thing. It doesn't look like some healthy corrective of Islamic theocracy. Christian theocracy works differently, especially under the auspices of federalism. Now, I would say this. Western civilization has an intellectual figurehead. That figurehead is Aristotle. And Aristotle was a Greek philosopher who Hellenized the West. And there was a really deliberate effort around America's birthday to de-Hellenize the West. And that was a really, really, really bad thing. And then not just intellectually, but morally and spiritually, the West was all built by the Christianity that was Aristotelian Christianity. You know it as Catholicism. It invented the idea of hospitals, medicine, hard science, matrimony, patriarchy, charities, libraries, universities, grade school, high school, orphanages, and the idea of Christendom, which means the right kind of integral mixture of church and state, not the creepy Islamic theocratic kind, but a specifically Christian kind. So it's a good thing. Yeah, lots of false indoctrination at the hands of the public schools on this particular matter.
So once upon a time, the church was the most powerful institution all over the globe, right? I mean, it influenced kings and queens, whole governments and so forth. Some might argue it still plays a fairly large role in American politics. I mean, take, for example, with the overturning of Roe. Is the church still a key player in global governance?
This is a tricky question. Roe versus Wade and the return to states' rights represented by Dobbs versus Bolton is largely a legacy win for the American Catholic Church. I mean, American Catholics were like a $3 bill because our ideas have always disproportionately informed the good elites in America, like Justice Thomas or Justice Scalia, particularly on the high court. But, you know, we're demographically, we've never been represented at the same ratio. So I would say Dobbs versus Bolton is the one bright spot, the small white pill, and it's not that small over the last decades. On the whole, I would say that American Catholics, who have always been this $3 bill, this side of the pond, have suffered from some of the stuff I've already mentioned. A church which is embarrassed of its own truth over the last 60 or 70 years. And that's the case even in Europe. Look at Ireland. And I studied in Rome. I was beginning a doctorate in Rome at a pontifical school. And the Italians in Rome, beautiful old city, they don't know what treasure of patrimony they're sitting on there in Rome. So the Europeans aren't much better. I would say that There's a confusing mishmash whereby the church, under this most unfortunate pontificate, number 266, is running around with folks that play geopolitics from the wrong angle, going the wrong direction, like Ban Ki-moon of the UN or Jeffrey Sachs or Emma Bonino. WEF, the church has, under Francis, has even had meetings with the World Economic Forum. It's truly unfortunate. So to whatever extent the church is influencing world politics under Pope Francis, it's been negative, and it's been more Catholics taking the lead of the people you would never want leading the world, like the WEF. Under his predecessor, Benedict XVI, things were a lot more traditional, and the church did still lead the world in some positive directions. Benedict XVI was known as a conservative, and American Protestants loved Benedict XVI, as did us faithful Catholics. I don't know why he left when he was so healthy. He was healthy for 10 years after he left. And it's really one of the great shames and mysteries of the modern era. But I would just say a historical nota bene as well, that the church, contrary to what you're going to be told in American public school, it was the great wound in Christendom when, you know, Martin Luther waged a revolution, and this really splintered Europe in a way where Europe had had univocity, political and cultural univocity that enabled Europe to really stand for something. It stood for the cross, even with its foibles, its exaggerated foibles in the history books. After the wound of the Protestant revolt, This changed the situation, and Europe became fractile in a way it never had been before. And it hadn't been even after 1054, when Church East and Church West split, the Latin and Greek church, which became, you know, Orthodox versus Catholic. that didn't do as much damage as 1517 to Christendom and the unity of Christians. That in many ways was pollinating the foundation of America, even though the foundation of America was largely good. And we've wound up in this situation where Christians feel scattered, divided, and leaderless here in the 21st century. It's really sad.
Timothy J. Gordon, philosopher, author of The Case for Patriarchy, and host of Rules for Retrogrades. Thank you so much for that deep insight today.
I really appreciate you having me. Thanks for the time, and I've really enjoyed it.
All right, that is going to do it for today's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy and current affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO.